Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Antonio Damasio, University professor, the David Dornseif Professor of Neuroscience, Psychology, and Philosophy, and Director of the Brain and Creativity Institute at the University of Southern California. We're talking about his latest book, The Strange Order of Things, Life, Feeling, and the Making of Cultures. Antonio, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
Pleasure to talk to you, too.
You write at the very beginning that this is a book about one interest and one idea. And it's a very complex book, but what is that one idea and that one interest that this book is about?
Well, the one interest is my long-standing interest in affect. Affect is a sort of umbrella term for emotions, feelings, the motivations that quite often run our lives. That's been a long-standing interest, and I have been doing research, and I've been on that, and I've been thinking about it for many, many years. The idea, you know, I'm very modest, and I don't even call it a hypothesis. I just want to call it an idea. The idea is that affect in general, and feelings in particular, have not been given the credit that they deserve as the motivators of a lot of our cultural inventions, right, and have never been thought about as terribly important to jumpstart the things that we invent all around us, whether they are in the realm of technology or science or governance, or even more important in very simple things that we have done to ourselves, such as inventing medicine so that we can treat ourselves when we are sick and suffer, or the systems that run our social life, not just governance, which is very particular, but, for example, moral systems that allow us to behave well or not so well towards others. And that central idea is really missing from the understanding that people have of cultures, because very often people think of all of these cultural practices and instruments as something that comes out of our prodigious intellect.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the fact that we're very smart people, or that we have certain qualities such as language, which clearly is important and is a factor. And I'm not denying that all of that is very important. You know, our intellectual capacity, the knowledge we accumulate, the reason with which we think about problems and sort of run through our inventions, that's all fine. But the fact is that the beginning of it, the motor for all of this, is affect. And if you don't factor that in, it's a little bit difficult to understand how we have developed and what we have achieved, both good and bad.
Why do you think that people have ignored affect, feelings, and their importance for so long and focused on the intellect? Is it simply because, from a scientific point of view, it's easier to deal with intelligence because we can measure it, and it seems to relate to brain size or brain weight. But people have really ignored the importance of affect, it seems, for as long as there's been science.
True. It's true in many respects, although there are exceptions. There have been periods, historically speaking, where affect has gotten a little bit of more due. Let's say, for example, in the 19th century, there was a period where a lot of giants of science, and that includes William James, for example, or Freud, or Darwin, for that matter, or the great French scientist Claude Bernard, where they actually gave enormous value to what was generally called emotion, which really is another umbrella term that cover many of these things. And if you go back to certain periods before, say in the 18th century, one of the great figures of the Enlightenment, David Hume, actually talked about reason always having to be a slave of the passions, which is a remarkable and very memorable sentence. But he was a little bit alone in that. I don't know. You know, it's very often, perhaps because the world of affect, the emotions and feelings, sometimes have a negative side. And of course, you have to understand that they are both negative and positive. You know, the
right.
Pain, for example, and suffering is obviously a negative thing, and pleasure is obviously a positive thing. But it's more complex than that, because there's certain emotional and feeling states that are actually profoundly negative and even destructive, such as, for example, anger or fear in many occasions, or contempt. So it's probably that the very manifest negative aspects of some emotions that have led people to think, well, it's not so good. And clearly, often is the case that emotions sort of derail a process that one could call a rational, reasonable process. And I think that's probably the reason. And the other thing is that sometimes people think it's kind of soft, you know, kind of rosy thing. And I get very upset with that, because you have to understand that there are positive emotions and negative emotions, the same way that there are good reasons and bad reasons. It's simply the way it is.
You go so far as to say that feelings are the catalysts for processes that we normally associate with intellect, things like questioning, understanding, and problem solving. And you view feelings as the catalysts for that.
Absolutely. As the catalyst, and there's something, Mark, that is very important, is that not only do they jumpstart the processes, they give the reasons. In fact, you should say that feelings give the reasons for certain processes to be initiated and certain pursuits to go on. But then they also serve as arbiters. I give, in the strange order of things, I give an example, which is a very simple example that has to do with medicine. If you are suffering with pain, and you go to your doctor, your doctor hopefully is going to give you some treatment, and the treatment may work or may not work. Now, the fact that you went to your doctor signifies the importance of feelings, because it was a feeling of pain, a feeling of discomfort, a feeling of having your life out of regulation that made you go to the doctor to seek help. Interestingly, there's a sort of counter feeling on the part of the doctor, because assuming he's a good doctor, he's going to be concerned with you, and he can be highly empathetic and
right.
sympathetic to you, or maybe not so much, but nonetheless, there's a counter feeling, which I think probably in the development of medicine, when you go back historically, must have been very important. But then there's something very interesting. It gives you the treatment. Now, suppose the treatment works, or suppose it doesn't work. How do you know? You know if it works or does not work also because of a feeling. It's the reduction of the feeling of pain and the entry into, say, well-being or non-pain that is going to tell you that it worked. And if it doesn't work, you're going to continue with that other feeling, and that also continues to regulate the process. So it's not just that it motivates. Feelings also are the arbiters of the success or failure of a certain intervention. So the importance continues. It's not just at the beginning, it continues. And I would say more broadly that feelings are extremely important negotiators of every process that we engage in terms of developing a particular instrument of culture, or especially in the social arena where we constantly have, and very often fail, especially currently, we very often fail to have that negotiation, because the tempers are so exasperated that you no longer can modulate the negotiation. But it is an effective negotiation. You only achieve so much by imposing reason on a process.
One of the key concepts of this book is a term called homeostasis.
Yep.
And I want you to explain that in relationship to what we're talking about affect.
Right. So it's very interesting. When you talk about feeling and sort of more generally the life of affect, I describe it in the book as sort of deputies. They're the representatives of a process that is deeper, which is the process of homeostasis. And I call them deputies because, of course, feelings only occur in individuals, in creatures that have nervous systems and have minds and have the possibility of having a relatively high level of representations of what is going on inside them and in the world. Now, feelings represent homeostasis, and homeostasis is a process that has existed ever since life appeared on Earth. So whereas feelings in all likelihood began relatively late in the history of life. Probably it's unlikely, I would say even impossible, that they existed more than 500 million years ago. However, homeostasis clearly existed from the get-go when first life appeared on Earth, and that we can push back to 3.9 billion years ago, which is really huge. And it simply is an automated process of regulation of life such that organisms, in that case, in the very early cases, single cells such as bacteria, could continue the life process, which means that they could continue searching for energy sources, generating energy, and saving some energy for the next day. In the case of bacteria, it's more appropriate to say for the next hour.
Right.
And so homeostasis is this remarkable process. You know, it has been described sort of poetically as a force or as an imperative, but it is really one of the defining features of life. It's this ability to continue a process that becomes sort of perpetual, and you run the cycle of your metabolism, and you continue, and you run it again, and that continues for as long as the organism permits it and does not age and does not collapse in that capacity. And it is, of course, a very defining aspect of our life, which is the reason why I think it is really quite beautiful to make this link between life in very simple forms that precede humans to feelings, which represent those forces and those processes at the conscious level in creatures that have a mind, and then connect all that to culture so that you don't see culture as a disembodied thing that does not connect with life. No, you want to see this as a continuity, which is a continuity in evolution, but which really, you know, it naturalizes the process of culture, which very often I'm worried about the fact that people see culture as something that is totally separate from the rest, when it is not. You know, it's part of this marvelous continuity of life on Earth.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Antonio Damasio, University Professor, the David Dornsife Professor of Neuroscience, Psychology, and Philosophy, and Director of the Brain and Creativity Institute at the University of Southern California. We're talking about his latest book. It's a great read, and I want to warn the audience, we cannot possibly do justice to it in 27 minutes. It's The Strange Order of Things, Life, Feeling, and the Making of Cultures. Antonio, it's fascinating that you talk about bacteria, like the beginning of life, that the origins of the idea of culture started there. And for the idea of social governance and concepts like that, even though bacteria don't have consciousness, that they don't have mind, but the idea of social behavior starts there. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so it's interesting. The those organisms are, to begin with, extremely social. And this is something that is important for your listeners and for my readers to know. Very often we think of an organism, one of us or some other living creature, in isolation. But the fact is that we are always social. And of course, it's obvious that we are very social in relation to our family structures and social structures around us. With us, it's quite obvious, even if sometimes the culture tends to see us in separation. But it's quite often the case that people don't see that in relation to other living organisms, especially in relation to something that, in fact, we do not see, such as bacteria and other microorganisms, because you need a microscope to get to them.
Right.
But those creatures are extremely social as well. So you have a group of bacteria, and of course they don't have eyes, they don't have minds, they don't have many of the features that are so natural to us, but they will behave very differently towards each other, depending, for example, on the kind of terrain in which they are. Now, suppose they are in a place which is rich in nutrients, has the right temperature for them to survive, and has the right kind of nutrients for them to pull in and generate energy and go about their lives. When that happens, they actually can afford to be relatively separate from each other. However, when the terrain is not so abundant, and when it has when there are difficulties in terms of getting food, literally quote unquote, then they band together. Or, for example, if there is a threat, suppose the bacteria are living in your throat, and you have a cold, which is really something worse than a cold, and your doctor gives you antibiotics. The antibiotic is going to fight the bacteria and, in fact, try to get rid of them. Well, guess what the bacteria do? They band together, and they generate a biofilm. They generate a substance that covers them and that literally insulates them and defends the group against the attack that your doctor is perpetrating on them. So it's all of these things, the marvel is that they're happening without anybody thinking.
I know.
That they're going to do that. It's just done naturally because that is the way the organism is designed to operate.
It's fascinating because it becomes, social behavior becomes another biological function then.
Absolutely. And it is. It's part of, and of course, it's a very critical component of the homeostatic process.
Yes.
If you're going to survive, you're going to need to have all these strategies to allow you to cope. And among themselves, they have strategies, for example, of cooperation, where they're going to be working for the same goal, or strategies of competition and conflict that literally can provoke a fight and lead one group to destroy another. So that's, of course, the reason why I've called the book The Strange Order of Things, is to make people aware that we really did not invent these things. We did not invent cooperation. We did not invent conflict. We did not invent the possibility of reacting with alarm at a threat, or reacting with calm and acceptance to something that is good. These are very fundamental aspects of life and the regulation and operation of life in whatever milieu the life is at a certain moment. What we have done over evolution, which is really beautiful, is that as complexity of organisms has increased, as we've gone from a single cell to many cells, different organ systems and so forth, all the way up to what we are, we have along the way acquired the possibility of having nervous systems, and those nervous systems at a certain point not only make the coordination of behavior beautiful and possible in a large organism, but they also start generating mind, which really means that you can make representations, mirrors of what is going on inside, mirrors of what is going on outside, and relate the interior and the exterior in a way that is intelligent and conducive to homeostasis, conducive to continuation of life. So that's a sort of later acquisition. But what the listeners and readers need to know is that it continues to have the same direction. And the direction that you have early on in bacteria is already the direction that we're following, which is let's maximize the possibility of survival of this organism, which really means maximizing the possibility of using energy and of staving off the decay of energy, which leads to death.
So, and it's important for people to understand that, and this is a quote from your book, nervous systems make minds not by themselves, but in cooperation with the rest of the body. And I think that's a misunderstanding that most people have, that when they think about minds, it's the brain, and that's all we're concerned about.
Very good. I'm glad that you seized on that, because that's something that in my work I have been emphasizing for a while, but with a certain degree of caution, because it's important to have the facts that support that idea, which I think I have, and I talk about several of them. But you're quite right. Very often, the brain is so important and is so distinctive that people have misconceived, quite naturally, the relationship of the brain and the body. So we very often think of the brain as the controller, and it's as if we were brains that require a body to support them, but it tends to be the other way around. In fact, we are bodies that have nervous systems as servants in order to maintain the body. The optic needs to change 180 degrees, and nervous systems, as they appeared in evolution very late, as we mentioned a while ago, nervous systems began as servants to the body. What they're doing is coordinating stuff so that life is possible. You see, if you have one single cell or a few, it's very often possible, it's always possible, to have chemical molecules that can be producing all the necessary effects, and they can run from one end to the other of the organism rapidly without great problem. Now, when you have an organism that is large and that is developing multiple organs and systems and so forth, you have this gigantic problem of coordinating what one part is doing with what another part is doing.
Right.
So, for example, when you have an immune system, which is develops very, very rapidly in living creatures, you need to defend ourselves against exterior threats that come in the form of pathogens. Okay, you have an immune system. But then you have the internal chemistry, which is critical for homeostasis, which really is sort of the precursor to our endocrine system, you know, hormones. And then you have circulation, because, of course, you need to go from one place to the other, delivering energy and collecting wastes, you know. It's a sort of combination of Amazon and garbage collection all in one. And you need a channel system that allows you to do this. And, of course, nature developed that as circulation. Later on, you know, in geography, you find rivers and channels and so forth. And then we developed as humans. We're very happy because we developed channels, and say you have all these canals in Amsterdam or in Venice. Well, you know, circulation was doing that a way back, and quite successfully, without having engineers and architects taking the credit for their brilliant imagination.
We're almost out of time, Antonio. And I've got like pages of questions left. But one of the things that, I mean, just as a thought problem, if I stub my toe, my mind is no longer calculating pi to the 20th place. I'm thinking about that part of my body. If I'm very hungry, yep, or any one of a number of body situations where I'm now, my homeostasis is out of alignment. It's amazing when you start thinking of things this way, it is obvious that your body has got a close relationship to what's going on with your mind. It's part of you. People need to realize that your body's not operating independent of your
brain and mind. Right.
It can't. In the examples I just mentioned, it drives the way what you're thinking, what you're planning on going to do next. I'm going to put a bandage on my wound. Yep. I'm going to go to the doctor. And it's not until I've read your book that you sort of realize that we've been stuck in the rut of thinking in a certain way about emotions, mind, and bodies.
Yep. And I think I hope it helps a little bit to put things in perspective and to see it's really a beautiful story.
It is.
It's just a story that can be told with different beginnings and different order of things. Let's put it this way. But I think the idea of negotiation, the idea that these demands that the affect system, which is really the homeostasis system, puts on our behavior through our minds, those demands need to be negotiated. And we are constantly in a process of arguing and resolving problems like that. And, you know, in fact, you can take them down to the trivial day-to-day with, for example, are you really going to have the chocolate that somebody has put in front of you? Are you going to have the dessert or not? Are you going to have the French fries that look so terrific?
Antonio, we're completely out of time. And I want to mention, and maybe we'll have another conversation later, but the last part of this book I think is critical for people to read because it's about a cultural crisis that's going on now and trying to understand that within the realm of what you're talking about in this book. My guest tonight has been Antonio Damasio, University Professor, the David Dornsif Professor of Neuroscience, Psychology, and Philosophy, and Director of the Brain and Creativity Institute at the University of Southern California. And we've been talking about his latest book. It is well worth a careful read. The Strange Order of Things, Life, Feeling, and the Making of Culture. Antonio, it's been a real pleasure.
Real pleasure to talk to you too, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.